The high-security cells of the toughest prisons are home to terrifying figures like Nico Allen Jenkins and Andre Chikadilo, the Butcher of Rostov. Known for their brutal crimes, these men continue to exert fear and control, even behind bars. Today, we look at some rare and disturbing footage that shows these men at their most intimidating. Nico Allen Jenkins. Nico Allen Jenkins, 27, the descendant of an Omaha chief, had a troubled past. He spent 10 and a half years in prison for car theft, where his violent behavior and mental health issues were ignored. Despite his record, Jenkins was released from prison on July 30, 2013, without adequate support or supervision. Just 2 weeks later, on August 11, Jenkins went on a killing spree that terrified Omaha, Nebraska. He lured two men, one Uribe Pena, 26, and Jorge C. Cahiga Ruiz, 25, to Spring Lake Park with the promise of a sexual encounter. He shot them in the head and stole their belongings, leaving their bodies in a white Ford pickup truck near a municipal swimming pool at 18th and F Streets. 8 days later, on August 19, Jenkins killed Curtis Bradford, 36, a man he had met in prison outside a detached garage at 18th and Clark Streets. The day before, Bradford had posed for a photo with Jenkins, unaware of the danger that awaited him. The photo, later found on Jenkins' phone, showed the two men smiling and hugging, a chilling prelude to the violence that was to come. Jenkins' final victim was Andrea Kruger, a 33-year-old mother of three, who was shot multiple times with a 12-gauge shotgun on August 21. His body was found at approximately 2:15 a.m., lying in the roadway at 168th Street and Ford. His vehicle, a 2002 Ford Expedition, was later found abandoned at 43rd Street and Charles after a failed attempt to set it on fire. Jenkins' crimes were caught on camera, and he was arrested on August 30 at the home of his girlfriend, Chelsea Blackley, 22. During an 8-hour interrogation, he confessed to the murders, claiming to be acting under the orders of an ancient serpent god, Apophis. Jenkins' trial was chaotic, and he portrayed himself and displayed unpredictable behavior. He spoke in tongues, howled, and laughed during his account of his victim's final moments. Despite his claims of mental illness, a psychiatrist deemed him competent to stand trial. Jenkins was sentenced to death by a three-judge panel consisting of Peter Battalion, Thomas Otepka, and Day Dougherty for the murders, and received an additional 450 years on the weapons charges. His case raised questions about the effectiveness of the prison system and the treatment of mentally ill inmates. The community grappled with the aftermath of Jenkins' crimes, and his name became synonymous with horror and fear. Jenkins' actions had a profound impact on the families of his victims, who were left to pick up the pieces and try to move forward. One Uribe Pena's mother, Maria Uribe, and Jorge Cahiga Ruiz's sister, Maria Cahiga Ruiz, were among the family members who testified during the trial, sharing stories of their loved ones and the devastating impact of their loss. CTI's Bradford's mother, Susan Bradford, and Andrea Kruger's husband, Michael Kruger, also spoke of their grief and struggle to come to terms with the senseless violence that had claimed the lives of their loved ones. Jenkins had a history of mental health issues, including schizophrenia and antisocial personality disorder, and had filed a federal lawsuit alleging that his mental health issues were worsened by his solitary confinement and his being ignored by prison officials. Next up is the man who held the record for the longest time held in solitary confinement by the Bureau of Prisons. Thomas Edward Silverstein. Thomas Silverstein was a man whose name struck fear into both inmates and guards at America's toughest prisons. Born Thomas Conway on February 4, 1952, in Long Beach, California. His childhood was marked by his parents' divorce and remarriage, which led to his adoption by Sid Silverstein. Thomas grew up learning self-defense, which taught him how to fight. At age 14, he got into trouble for his violent behavior and was sent to a juvenile detention center where he learned how to survive and thrive in a harsh environment. In 1971, Thomas turned to crime, earning his first major sentence in San Quentin Prison for armed robbery. After a brief period of release, he was arrested again in 1975, along with his father and cousin, for a series of armed robberies. In 1977, he was sentenced to 15 years in Leavenworth, Kansas, where his reputation grew. The harsh prison environment and his involvement with the Brotherhood, a feared gang of inmates, made him a symbol of fear within the prison system. As Thomas's power within the Aryan Brotherhood grew, so did his reputation. The violent nature of the gang and Thomas' aggressive behavior formed a dangerous combination that led to him becoming the most feared man in prison. This title was further cemented by a series of grisly events that occurred at the United States Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. In 1980, Thomas arrived at USP Marion, where he became more deeply involved with the Aryan Brotherhood. The gang was known for its racist beliefs and brutal control over the prison hierarchy. The first event in this dark history was the murder of inmate Danny Adwell, for which Thomas was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. However, his conviction was later overturned in 1985 when key witnesses were found to have lied. Despite this, Thomas' reputation as a ruthless enforcer was cemented. Another violent incident occurred in 1981 when Thomas was accused of murdering Robert Chapel, a member of the rival DC Black Gang. Tensions between the two gangs were growing, and the arrival of Raymond Lee Cadillac Smith, leader of the DC Blacks, set the stage for a bloody showdown. Thomas and fellow inmate Clayton Fountain were convicted of the brutal murder of Smith, whom they stabbed 67 times with improvised weapons. The aftermath was a horrific display of power, as Smith's body was paraded through the prison, sending a chilling message to all who saw it. Thomas was sentenced to life in prison for this savage act. The most significant and violent event in Thomas Silverstein's life occurred on October 22, 1983. He planned and carried out the murder of correctional officer Merle Klutz, using a homemade knife and a key given to him by another inmate to attack Klutz, stabbing him multiple times. This was not just an act of violence, but a declaration of war against the prison system that Thomas felt had wronged him. Thomas Silverstein spent 36 of his 42 years in solitary confinement, isolated from the rest of the world. He was incarcerated in a specially designed cell at the ADX Florence Federal Penitentiary in Colorado, a maximum security prison designed for the most dangerous inmates. At the time of his death in 2019, he held the record for the longest-serving inmate held in solitary confinement within the Bureau of Prisons. His solitary confinement was the result of his violent actions, including the murder of correctional officer Merle Klutz, which resulted in his permanent isolation from the rest of the inmate population. Next up, the creepy man who is the longest-serving inmate, Alvin Karpyz. This footage comes from the darkest corners of America's prisons. The most feared man behind bars, Alvin Karpyz was a man who whispered fear. His mere presence sent shivers down the spines of even the most hardened criminals. A criminal mastermind, Karpyz was the only public enemy number one ever captured alive by the FBI. His sinister smile earned him the nickname, Creepy. Born in Montreal, Quebec, on August 10, 1907, Karpyz's childhood in Topeka, Kansas, was far from ideal. By age 10, he was already associating with gamblers, bootleggers, and pimps. At 19, he was sentenced to 10 years for attempted robbery. However, he escaped and embarked on a crime spree with his partner Lawrence de V. Karpyz's career took a major turn when he met Fred Barker in the Kansas State Penitentiary. Together, they formed the infamous Barker-Karpyz Gang, which terrorized the American Midwest with bank robberies, kidnappings, and cold-blooded efficiency. Their reign of terror ended with the murder of Sheriff Roy Kelly, which cemented Karpyz's reputation as a man to be reckoned with. The downfall of the Barker-Karpyz Gang was marked by violence and bloodshed. The FBI, under the command of J. Edgar Hubert, intensified its efforts and the gang came under siege. The turning point came with the kidnapping of Edward Bremer, which incurred the wrath of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. The FBI's relentless pursuit ended with Karpyz's dramatic capture on May 1, 1936, in New Orleans. Karpyz's trial was swift and he was sentenced to life in prison. He spent 26 long years in the federal penitentiary at Alcatraz, the longest-serving prisoner in its history. While there, Karpeyes met a young Charles Manson and taught him how to play the guitar. Karpeyes' story is a testament to the transformative power of time and the lasting impact one man can leave on others, even in the darkest of places. Upon his parole in 1969 after more than 30 years in prison, Alvin Karpeyes found himself confronted with a very different world. No longer a feared criminal mastermind, Karpeyes struggled to fit into a changing society. Deported to Canada, he had difficulty obtaining a Canadian passport due to his earlier decision to remove his fingerprints. Despite these difficulties, he settled in Montreal and attempted to live a normal life. Karpeyes dealt with his difficult past by writing his memoirs, which offered an honest look at his life of crime and his time in Alcatraz. His books portrayed a man coming to terms with the daily grind of life after overcoming his shame. In 1973, Karpeyes sought peace in Spain. He died on August 26, 1979, initially by suicide but later determined to be of natural causes. The next most famous mobster in American history is Al Capone. This is a rare footage of Capone, also known as Scarface, a notorious criminal who ruled the underworld during the Roaring Twenties. But what happened when this crime boss responsible for the infamous St. Valentine's Day massacre ended up behind bars? Capone's story begins in Brooklyn, New York, where he was born on January 17, 1899, to Italian immigrants. His life was a dark version of the American dream. Capone's rise to power began when he joined the Five Points Gang as a young man, learning criminal skills that would help him build his empire. Capone was noticed by Johnny Torrio, a Chicago crime boss, and offered him the chance to relocate to Chicago, where he learned how to run illegal businesses and bribe officials. During Prohibition, Capone's business ventures flourished, making him a powerful figure in Chicago. However, his success created enemies for him, including the Northside Gang, and the streets became a battleground. Capone emerged victorious through his charm and brutal tactics, eventually seizing control of the Chicago outfit. His reputation for violence and intelligence made him feared, but it also led to his downfall and imprisonment. Capone's story illustrates the dark side of the American dream, where crime and violence can lead to power and fame. The streets became a battleground for gang warfare that culminated in the infamous St. Valentine's Day massacre on February 14, 1929. 7 members of the Northside Gang were brutally murdered. An act that many believed was orchestrated by Capone, although he was never officially linked to the crime. The St. Valentine's Day massacre was a brutal wake-up call that shocked the country. Public opinion turned against Capone, and authorities indicted him on tax evasion charges in 1931. They used a letter from his lawyer inadvertently admitting to his substantial taxable income to build their case. On October 17, 1931, a jury found Capone guilty of tax evasion. He was sentenced to 11 years in federal prison, fined $50,000, and ordered to pay court costs. This was a historic moment, a victory for the legal system, and the beginning of Capone's journey from the lap of luxury to the harsh cells of America's most notorious prisons. Al Capone arrived at the Atlanta Penitentiary in May 1932, where he began his 11-year sentence. The man who once ruled Chicago with an iron fist found himself in a world where his power meant nothing. Capone struggled to adjust to the harsh realities of prison life, and his influence quickly waned. Due to his notoriety, he became a target for both inmates and prison officials. Despite his attempts to manipulate the system, his usual tactics did not work in the harsh prison environment. Rumors spread that Capone was receiving special treatment and continuing his criminal operations from the inside, leading to his transfer to the federal penitentiary at Alcatraz in August 1934. Alcatraz, known as the Rock, was a place where reputations like Capone's went to die. The strict regimen and isolation took their toll on Capone's mental state, and his health began to deteriorate due to untreated syphilis. The syphilis that ravaged his body was treated too late, causing irreversible damage. By the time he was released from Alcatraz in November 1939, he was frail and mentally deteriorated, a shadow of the notorious figure he had once been. His struggle with neurosyphilis had taken its toll, and the man who returned to his Palm Island mansion in Florida was a far cry from the kingpin who had once ruled Chicago's underworld. Capone was a broken man, his mind frail by the day. He suffered a stroke on January 25, 1947, and died of cardiac arrest the following day. News of his death made headlines, but the public perception of Capone had changed. The fear he had caused had faded, and now people felt a mix of curiosity and sympathy for the powerful figure who had fallen. Unlike Al Capone, the next man was shown no sympathy at all and was executed by lethal injection. John Wayne Gacy. Below are images of the fearsome John Wayne Gacy, known as the Killer Clown, a terrifying figure who committed horrific crimes. His presence made even the most hardened criminals tremble with fear. His crimes were so serious that they left an indelible mark of fear in the prison where he was held. Gacy had a difficult childhood with an abusive father who would read him with his words and fists. He tried to appear normal, but beneath the surface he hid dark secrets. In 1968, he was convicted of a felony and served 18 months in prison. After his release, Gacy's crimes escalated. He started a business, performed as a clown, and committed his first known murder in 1972. This began a crime spree that terrorized the community and baffled law enforcement for years. Gacy had crossed a line and became one of the most feared men in prison. After serving 18 months, Gacy appeared to reform. He started a business, entered politics, and even met the First Lady. But beneath his cheerful exterior was a calculating predator. The crawl space under his home was a makeshift cemetery where the remains of 26 young women were found. The investigation into Gacy's crimes was a massive undertaking that stretched the boundaries of law enforcement in the 1970s. Detectives persisted despite Gacy's denials and uncovered the truth, finding the remains of dozens of young women. Gacy's crimes were recorded and his every move became infamous, making him one of the most feared men in prison. Identifying the victims of John Wayne Gacy's crimes was a difficult task. Forensic experts used a variety of techniques, including dental records and x-rays, to identify the victims. The process was slow and painstaking, with each discovery adding to the tragedy. Investigators also had to piece together Gacy's movements over the years, locate the last known whereabouts of his victims, and piece together a timeline of his crimes. As the case progressed, law enforcement delved into Gacy's past and uncovered a pattern of abuse and manipulation dating back to his first conviction. They interviewed survivors who told them how they narrowly escaped Gacy's clutches. Their testimony demonstrated that Gacy was not only good at deceiving people, but also an expert at avoiding suspicion. Gacy's trial began in February 1980 and became a national sensation. The courtroom became a battleground as the defense and prosecution argued over Gacy's fate. The defense argued that Gacy suffered from multiple personality disorders that drove him to commit his crimes. In contrast, the prosecution presented a methodical case emphasizing the premeditation and calculation behind Gacy's actions. The trial was not just a legal proceeding, it was a public spectacle that captured the nation's attention. The media extensively covered every aspect of the case, from the gruesome evidence to the emotional toll on the victims' families. The trial also had a profound effect on the justice system, highlighting the need for improved methods of tracking serial offenders and supporting the families of missing persons. Ultimately, the jury found Gacy guilty of all 33 counts of murder. He was sentenced to death by lethal injection, bringing closure to a case that had haunted the nation. His crimes shattered the innocence of the Norwood Park Borough and struck fear into the hearts of those who encountered him, both in society and later in prison. The following story concerns a man known for his charisma and deceit, qualities that concealed his horrific crimes for a long time. Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer. Images from a maximum security prison show Jeffrey Dahmer, also known as the Milwaukee Cannibal, who was feared even by his fellow inmates. His crimes were so heinous that they made him a household name. Dahmer's life began in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he was born on May 21, 1960, to Lionel and Joyce Dahmer. His early years seemed normal, but he exhibited unusual behavior, such as collecting dead animals and experimenting on their corpses. Dahmer's home life was troubled with parents who argued frequently and a mother who had mental health issues. He became withdrawn and began drinking to cope with his loneliness and confusion about his sexuality. After high school, Dahmer committed his first murder. He killed a hitchhiker named Stephen Hicks and scattered his remains in the woods. This marked the beginning of a series of brutal murders that would span several years. Dahmer's life was marked by setbacks and setbacks. He dropped out of Ohio State University. He was discharged from the army due to his drinking problems and was arrested for disorderly conduct. Despite finding work at the Milwaukee Blood Plasma Center and the Ambrosia Chocolate Factory, his dark impulses continued to grow. He began frequenting gay bars and bathhouses, drugging men, and performing sexual acts on them while they were unconscious. In 1987, Dahmer's violent tendencies resurfaced, and he began a series of brutal murders that would span several years. His target was young men, whom he would lure with money or companionship, then drug and strangle to death. He would dismember their bodies and take photographs as twisted mementos. Dahmer's psychological problems made him a troubled individual who craved control and feared abandonment. He experimented by drilling holes in his victims' skulls and injecting hydrochloric acid or boiling water into their frontal lobes, attempting to create zombies that would obey his commands. Dahmer's ability to present a normal facade allowed him to continue his murders undetected. He was a master of manipulation, using his charm and good looks to lure victims into his trap. However, his downfall came when one victim, Tracy Edwards, escaped and led police officers Robert Rout and Rolf Muller to his apartment. The officers found a collection of Polaroid photographs depicting Dahmer's gruesome activities, and he was arrested. A subsequent search of Dahmer's apartment revealed the extent of his gruesome practices. Investigators found severed heads in the refrigerator, dismembered body parts in the freezer, and an altar filled with human skulls and bones. The apartment was a shrine to his perverse desires, and the evidence was overwhelming. Jeffrey Dahmer's trial captivated and horrified a worldwide audience. He was convicted and sentenced to 15 consecutive life sentences totaling 957 years in prison. The trial was an ordeal for the families of his victims, who were exposed to graphic details of their loved ones' final moments. In prison, Dahmer found religion and sought redemption, but he continued to be the target of retaliation. He survived an initial attack by a fellow inmate but was eventually beaten to death by Christopher Scarber, an inmate with a history of mental illness. On November 28, 1994, Dahmer's death shocked the prison system and the public, bringing bittersweet relief to the families of his victims. Dahmer's legacy is a chilling and tragic reminder of humanity's darkest aspects. Next up, the Ukrainian butcher who targeted mostly young boys and mutilated their bodies. Andrei Romanovich Chikatilo. The terrifying images of Andrei Chikatilo, the butcher of Rostov, a serial killer whose crimes shocked the Soviet Union. His reign of terror lasted for over a decade, leaving a trail of blood and terrorizing the nation. Chikatilo was born on October 16, 1936, in the village of Yablochna, Ukraine, during a time of great hardship. His childhood was marked by poverty, hunger, and violence. His family struggled to survive, and his mother's tales of horror and cannibalism left a lasting impact on him. The war years brought further trauma, and Chikatilo experienced the atrocities of the conflict firsthand. As a young man, Chikatilo struggled with impotence and was ridiculed by his peers. He became a teacher, but was ineffective and humiliated by his students. His dark impulses began to surface, and in 1973 he committed his first sexual assault. It was the beginning of a descent into unspeakable violence. Chikatilo's crimes were not just murders, they were rituals of control and domination. He targeted young men, mostly boys, and mutilated their bodies. He would lure them to isolated areas, strangle them, and then mutilate their bodies, often removing their genitals and eyes. At first, the Soviet police were reluctant to accept the idea of a serial killer, but as the body count mounted, they launched an investigation. The investigation proved difficult due to outdated forensic methods and a lack of resources. However, new techniques such as blood typing eventually led to Chikatilo's capture in 1990. He was arrested for suspicious behavior at a train station in Rostov-on-Don and was subsequently linked to the murders through evidence including matching fingerprints and eyewitness testimony. He became a feared figure, not only by the general public but also by his eventual fellow prisoners. His reputation preceded him, and within prison walls he was regarded with a mixture of horror and fascination. Chikao's early life and psychological makeup were key to understanding the man who would become one of the most feared individuals in criminal history. Chikao's interrogation was a psychological battle that oscillated between defiance and moments of honesty. He eventually confessed to 52 murders, although some estimates put the number of victims as high as 60. His trial began in 1992 and was a media frenzy with journalists from around the world covering the story. Chikatilo's crimes were exposed to the world's public gaze, and the press dubbed him the Mad Beast and the Butcher of Rostov. The trial was marked by Chikatilo's erratic behavior, who would burst into song or engage in incoherent verbal attacks. He was convicted and sentenced to death. He was executed by firing squad on February 14, 1994, in a Russian prison. Chikatilo's case had a lasting impact on the justice system, highlighting the need for modern forensic techniques and more effective investigative methods. It also raised questions about the effectiveness of law enforcement and the capacity for evil in the human psyche. The case remains one of the most infamous in Russian criminal history, and Chikatilo's name is synonymous with unspeakable evil. Next up is the serial killer who appeared on a dating show, Rodney Alcala. This footage shows Rodney Alcala, a serial killer who appeared on the television show The Dating Game in 1978, hiding his dark secrets behind a charming smile. He was the number one bachelor, answering questions with a flirtatious tone that masked his true intentions. Unbeknownst to the audience, the man they saw on stage was a brutal predator who had already claimed several lives, including those of Pamela Lamb, Jill Barcom, Georgia Wickstead, Charlotte Lamb, and Jill Parenteau. Alcala's appearance on the show was in stark contrast to his heinous crimes. He knew how to manipulate people, which served him well in luring his victims. The format of the show worked in his favor, allowing him to showcase his charm. Host Jim Langer was a free-for-all and kept the jokes going. Alcala's innuendo-filled answers masked the darkness inside him, as he played the part of a bachelor looking for a fun date rather than a murderer evading capture. However, Cher Bradshaw, the bachelorette who chose him, later said she felt uncomfortable around him and refused to go on a date with him. A decision that might have saved her life. "He was creepy," Bradshaw said. "I felt uncomfortable around him." While Alcala was courting Bradshaw on television, investigators were piecing together a series of brutal murders that would eventually be linked to him. His method of working involved luring young women with the promise of a photo shoot and then assaulting, torturing, and killing them. The revelation of Alcala's true identity would come too late for his victims. The investigation that led to Alcala's arrest and trial was complex, involving missed opportunities and dogged detective work. It began with the disappearance of 12-year-old Robin Christine Samsey in 1979. Detectives canvassed the area for clues, interviewing witnesses and following up on leads. One crucial piece of evidence was a pair of gold ball earrings found in a small bag in Alcala's closet. These earrings would later become key forensic evidence linking him to Samso, as his mother identified them as belonging to her daughter. Alcala was arrested on July 24, 1979, and charged with Samso's kidnapping and murder. He represented himself in court, using bizarre and disturbing tactics to try to charm and fool the jury. Despite his efforts, the evidence against him was overwhelming and he was convicted of Samso's murder and sentenced to death in 1980. However, Alcala's conviction was overturned twice on technicalities and each time he faced retrials. With each trial, more evidence came to light, including a set of photographs taken by Alcala of his intended victims. In 2010, more than 30 years after his initial arrest, Alcala was convicted of 4 more murders and sentenced to death for a third time. Alcala's case serves as a stark warning about the dangers of manipulation and underscores the importance of persistence in the pursuit of justice. His ability to hide in plain sight and seduce those around him made him a formidable predator. Eventually, however, his crimes caught up with him and he was brought to justice. Next up is the BTK killer who terrorized Wichita for over 30 years. Dennis Rader. These are images of Dennis Rader, the infamous BTK killer, Bind Torture Killer, who was born on March 9, 1945, in Pittsburgh, Kansas. He grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and seemed like a regular guy. He was a Boy Scout, a churchgoer, and an educated man. After high school, he enlisted in the Eisenhower Air Force from 1966 to 1970 and later worked at Coleman and Addity Security Services. But beneath his ordinary exterior, Rader hid dark secrets. He had twisted sexual fantasies, hurt animals, and enjoyed spying on people and dressing as a woman. In 1971, Rader married Paula Ditz and had 2 children, Brian and Carrie. To his neighbors, he was an ordinary family man, but inside he was a ticking time bomb. On January 15, 1974, he began his killing spree by murdering the Otero family. Joseph, Julie, Josephine, and Joseph Jr. were tied up and strangled without a trace. Rader continued killing, taunting the police with cryptic letters and messages. He believed he was smarter than them and wanted to be famous for his crimes. Rader led a double life. He worked, raised his children, and attended Christ Lutheran Church, all while hiding his dark secret. He was a scout leader, a city employee, and a church member, which made it difficult for the police to suspect him. Over the years, Rader's crimes became more daring and he left more clues, but the police were unable to catch him. He killed Catherine Bright in 1974, Maureen Hedgick in 1977, and the Davis family, Vicky, Dolores, and Don in 1986. He also murdered Nancy Fox in 1987 and Dolores Davis in 1991. In 2004, Rader began sending letters and floppy disks to the police, which eventually led to his capture. He asked if a floppy disk could be traced, and when they told him no, he sent one that led the police to his church and then to him. The final piece of evidence was DNA from a pap smear of his daughter Carrie, which matched DNA from the crime scenes. Rader was arrested on February 25, 2005, and charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder. He pleaded guilty and confessed to his crimes without showing any remorse. He is now serving 10 life sentences plus 175 years in prison at El Dorado Correctional Facility, where he is closely guarded and has no control over his actions. Police and FBI agents involved in the case were relieved to finally catch the BTK killer who had terrorized Wichita for over 30 years. The victims' families finally had closure, and the community could breathe a sigh of relief knowing that the monster who had haunted their dreams was behind bars. He hid his dark secrets, pretending to be normal, deceiving even those closest to him. His crimes were brutal and senseless, leaving a trail of devastation and pain in his wake. But thanks to the tireless efforts of law enforcement and forensic science, Rader was finally brought to justice, ending his reign of terror and providing closure for the victims and their families. For more thrilling content, click on the boxes that appear on your screen to view similar content. M.